Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 704.EC0202, certificate number 37919. Laugh tracks.
Come and get it!
Maxwell.
When you first took over Jeopardy, I remember it very clearly.
First of all, I didn't take over. It wasn't a coup. When I rode triumphantly into the streets of Culver City and the military defected to my side.
But after Alex died, RIP.
The greatest.
You were the first person to host Jeopardy in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah. In fact, like I had already been scheduled to come in and tape that week, just because his health was not great. He was going to start a new round of cancer treatments. Mm-hmm. And so I was already scheduled to come in. So I'm supposed to come in on Sunday morning and rehearse for new shows that week. I think Monday, Tuesday, contestants were flying in that day. And I got a call that morning, like early crack of dawn, saying Alex passed away last night.
Wow.
And I had, the last time I had talked to him, he did not sound great, but I was really thinking like, you know what? This guy is going to be back. Like,
yeah.
It's weird that I'm going to be his Joey Bishop for a week and be his guest host, Joan Rivers or whatever. But thank goodness, like Alex is still going to host.
Had he had a guest host before?
No, with one exception, April Fool's Day at some point in the 90s, without any comment, which kind of makes it brilliant. Pat Sajak hosted Jeopardy and Alex hosted Wheel.
Oh.
And they just never mentioned it. It was as if it had just had beamed in from a parallel universe where the weirdest possible choice had been made for who should host two shows.
Have you seen those shows?
I actually have not, although yeah, I could. I have access. I could watch the Jeopardy one. I have access to an internal Sony thing that lets me look at catalog shows, like including ones nobody's ever seen.
I wonder if those would be actually good, if Alex hosting Wheel of Fortune would be like a...
If I remember right, cool. Yeah, I would like to see that one more than... Because I think Pat's just like a just kind of a natural showman. He could just step into Jeopardy and it wouldn't have Alex's gravitas necessarily, but like technically Pat could do it in his sleep. But I think they made it a little more April Fools-y. Like I think the final Jeopardy category was like Jamaican ichthyologists or something. And then it turned out to be a gettable thing about some guy whose name we know. Maybe Guppy? I can't remember. But, they played up the April Fool's thing there, but nothing with the host. So except for that, Alex had hosted every single show for 37 and a half years.
Were you already in California when you got the call? Or is this the type of thing you were at SeaTac waiting for your flight?
It was during COVID, but we were shooting another show. I was taping another game show, I think, for GSN. I was doing the Chase show for ABC, mm-hmm. but I think I was up in Studio City doing this game show called Masterminds on GSN.
I remember.
And I got the phone call. saying, hey, we need a fill-in. And I can't remember if I flew up and back. I may have flown up and back. No, actually, I think that was the weekend I was going to fly up and back, and they very kindly flew my family down.
Oh.
So I could see them.
So, but this is happening during the pandemic when Jeopardy, as we've discussed before, is filmed in front of a live studio audience. And the audience reactions are part of the appeal of the show. I mean, it's not like people are hooting and hollering, but...
It's not like Price is Right.
No,
but when you hear applause or laughter, that's real.
And the camera doesn't really pan across the audience that much in Jeopardy, not like Price is Right.
No, beginning of at the top of the show, you see the audience kind of in the darkness as we move to the stage. And then occasionally there will be a look back at the audience during a commercial break or bumper.
But it's a considerable crowd, and they do, your producer does kind of get us all clapping as it comes out of commercial. And, you know, there is a lot of audience participation.
Yeah, Jimmy McGuire, who used to be in the Clue crew, you know, he'd be the guy, hey, we're here in Easter Island. He's now kind of the stage manager and hype man. So yeah. He's running the whole show, including the audience.
I like that he wears a big clock around his neck on a gold chain.
Yo, yo, yo.
But so you took over Jeopardy you began your tenure hosting Jeopardy.
Like guest hosting at the time.
Guest hosting at the time in front of an empty room?
Yes.
And had Alex been taping in front of an audience-less room for the first year of the pandemic?
He had, and he hated it. Jeopardy was down for not that long after the initial shutdown. We might have been one of the first shows. Jeopardy and Wheel might have been the first shows back up and running.
Yeah, it's a national security.
It's a utility. Yeah, question. Alex Trebek's a first responder
for sure.
Basically, like when you think of how many senior citizens need Alex Trebek versus how many need an EMT, it's not even close.
Yeah, they all need Alex Trebek.
Exactly.
Think of the riots that would be happening in
the Trebek riots.
Yeah, the hospitals across the country.
People are wearing his face like it's a Guy Fawkes mask or Luigi or whatever. So he had to do his last shows too. So Jeopardy came back very quickly. And Alex, first of all, when he was at home, even though he's like fighting stage four cancer, he was like, when are we going to be back? When are we going to be back? You know, he just wanted to be back in the studio. And he didn't love the empty room because he was like a TV guy for six decades or something.
He fed off of the space.
He loved taking questions from the audience during the breaks, and he loved the real reactions. He was kind of a showman.
You know, I told you he came out in one of the commercial breaks to talk to the audience. And he was like, anybody got any questions? And, you know, it's one of these situations where everybody's kind of shy to speak up. And half the room was Sony execs. So they're...
You were there at the GOAT tournament.
Yeah. And so, of course, I'm always happy to be the one that breaks the ice. And I said...
Did I ever tell you about the time I walked across Europe?
He said, Alex, how do we make this about me? I said, what's the worst thing that's ever happened at a Jeopardy taping? And he's, you know, a consummate showman and doesn't want to talk about the worst
thing that ever happened.
It's just like, that is not, and he did such a good job of just like eliding me from just like, oh yes, what a great question. Well, you know, the best thing that ever happened, like just completely.
I bet he got laughs with his whatever he did.
Yeah, he did.
He was very good.
He did. He pivoted, but.
I'm sure he remembers whatever, a kid crying in Kids Week or...
Yeah, there was some kind of... Yeah.
I'm sure he remembered something but did not want to...
You saw it flash in front of his eyes. He was like, oh my God.
Saigon. I'm still in Saigon.
So what was it like for you having spent all those years on that stage in front of a studio audience to suddenly be out there in what would be a cavernous space?
Yeah, empty chairs.
With just the Blues Cruise crew and then your three contestants.
It felt like kind of a fake show. You know, it felt like we were simulating Jeopardy on the holodeck. You know, you would not think the live audience, you know, the 100 people who got off a tour bus and, you know, bought tickets online or whatever, you'd think that would not be central to making Jeopardy happen. In fact, you'd wonder, do they really have to be there? But for the experience of the people who were there, it is absolutely central, it turns out, to have that live audience.
And so did the producers like put any kind of canned audience reactions into the broadcast?
It would be so funny if they didn't, right? Just like no applause.
Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Tumbleweed.
Well, I don't, you know, do you really want to know?
It's just long. It's like Between Two Ferns or Space Ghost or something where there's just long, long stretches of room tone. No, they dropped in canned applause and canned laughter. You know, luckily it can be pretty gentle because Jeopardy's never that, I don't want to say it's never that funny or applause worthy, but it's not a show where the audience just freaks out at some amazing gag or something like if you're at a All in the Family taping in 1972.
I went to a Daily Show taping and it's a smaller room, or was, and also just a raucous crowd, right? Everybody's just, they're all drunk, and presumably everyone working on the show was drunk. It was just a zoo. But yeah, right. The audience response is there, but there's somebody there, like a hype person on the side of the stage, really like, come on, let's get the, you know, make it sound good.
Partly for the performers, I bet. Can you imagine how much different they are when they just feel like they're killing?
Yeah.
But also for the, you know, the home audience is like, oh, look how much fun they're having.
Yeah, it's a comedy show as opposed to Jeopardy, which is...
There are plenty of funny TV comedies that have no laugh reply at all, and yet they still play just fine. You know, that's not necessary to have that. And yet, we've chosen that to be the standard of the industry for 70 years.
Well, it's funny because now you've probably, because you're a member of the industry and you sometimes read the Hollywood Reporter.
Just reading the trades.
Just going through, probably read it online where you have to cancel out some intrusive ad every 15 seconds, just throws something up in the middle of the article you're reading. Come on, stop it. As you probably know, laugh tracks have for decades now been very controversial in the entertainment business. There are so many, I mean, it's very hipster to hate them.
Right.
It's been fashionable.
All the Office alike shows don't have them.
Don't have them. And really trade on the uncomfortable silences.
Right.
And it's been a popular meme on the web for a long time to post Friends episodes where the laugh track is taken out. And the first time I saw one of those, I couldn't believe it. It was the show is so appalling. Like really.
To your sensibilities or?
Well, if you take the laughter out of Friends, it immediately feels, and I feel like this is true of any episode, it feels like the people on stage hate one another and the show is mean and cruel.
Well, the problem is you're leaving in all the pauses, right? When they cut out the laugh track, they do not shrink the dialogue reaction times.
Yeah.
So that's probably largely what you're seeing.
Yeah. Right? Somebody says like, well, I hope you die. And then there's just a long pause while the other person stares at them.
Chandler.
And if you watch it with the laugh track, you know, there's the room losing it. But
Chandler's not a serial killer. If people,
I hope you die. And it's just like, what, why would he say that? Like really mean show. And I think a lot of the critical cultural feeling about that is that the laugh track allows for really lazy writing, a lot of kind of just mean jokes.
We'll tell you what the punchline is.
Yeah, you're going to laugh because here it is.
It doesn't actually have to work. Others are laughing.
But
conversely, by the way, have you seen the clips where they take a newer show and layer in old-timey canned laughter?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you can see that too.
What does that look like? I mean, 30 Rock as an example, as a show, is one of the few shows that I've watched and have watched now 100 times all the way through.
For you, it's 3,000 Rock.
3,000 Rock. The jokes are so fast and it just is moving so fast. I don't know where you
how would you
put
do
laughs.
It? Yeah, how would you
it's
do
just
it?
Like boom, boom, boom. And so many of them are visual jokes and it's just like it wouldn't, laughs would just be, would be confusing, clutter.
I think in the movies, the Marx Brothers famously would re-edit their movies after watching them with a live audience. And maybe they would do it, maybe this would often happen when they were doing it as a live Broadway show before it became a movie. They would know what because they didn't want theater audiences laughing over the next joke or the next line of dialogue.
Right.
So they would have to add in kind of awkward pauses, just like your Friends video, just so that people could hear what Groucho would say next. And today we just don't do that. Like even movies or TV shows with very fast-paced gags just kind of count on you to keep paying attention or you're going to miss something.
But that is very true of shows recorded in front of a live studio audience, that the energy, not just talk shows, but sitcoms, the energy of the audience laughter does inspire a different performance.
Yep.
And those shows, those sitcoms that had studio audiences, you can see when they're really killing.
It's also, you can tell, yes, like it's funny to watch an old Cheers or something and just realize that some scene is really working because the laughs mount, right?
Yeah.
Conversely, they can see when a joke doesn't work and replace it.
Right.
Which you cannot do without a live audience.
Yeah. And that's the difference between like a 3-camera shoot and a 1-camera shoot.
Do you want to explain that to people who don't know?
Well, a 3-camera shoot, right, is mostly, well, why don't you explain it? You're the show business guy.
Like, as I understand it, it's an I Love Lucy thing. There are some antecedents in other genres, but it's basically invented by Lucy and Desi and their director. The idea being that the show is performed like a play.
Right.
With an audience watching. So essentially they're recording it live to tape, live to kinescope in this case, with 3 cameras capturing everything at all times, but not interfering with the audience's view or the view of the other cameras.
Yeah.
So a director in a booth can switch between them like at a sporting event.
Cameras on the wings and one that's kind of moving around the front.
The way talk shows and game shows are still recorded today. Where a single camera...
Single camera, each shot has to be kind of set up.
Yes.
And you capture it in the camera and then you move on to the next shot. And if you are...
Shot like a movie.
Yeah. And you can do retakes and you can, you know, like you see, it's maybe one of my favorite things about the internet, watching bloopers of the Seinfeld show, which now, along with horse hoof trimming videos, Seinfeld bloopers and, and helicopter crashes are basically what
the algorithm wants you to watch.
Just decided, like, this is what you like.
We just put out bloopers of me on Jeopardy for the first time, like this season.
Oh.
And one thing I realized is that they're bizarre because when you watch a sitcom blooper reel, the actors react to each other.
Yeah.
And that's fun. They'll be cracking each other up that's what you want to see in a Seinfeld
reel. Julia Louis-Dreyfus just laughing. Yeah. I mean, I've probably watched 100 hours of it.
It's delightful. Yeah. And especially if it's the sixth time and Jerry Stiller is saying something and nobody can keep it together again.
Yeah. Kramer's always mad.
And yes, exactly. He's the one who doesn't break.
Yeah.
Whereas on Jeopardy, it's just me making a mistake and then I'm alone in this blue void. And I say, let's do that again. It's not the same.
Well, we talked about that, right? During the GOAT tournament, watching Alex have to redo things.
A clue occasionally. He would rarely have to, but as he got older, occasionally he would do clue pickups during some breaks.
But at the show I saw, he was mad. He was frustrated.
I remember what happened. Do you remember what the thing was he kept doing?
No.
They Jeopardy always has dollar values on the clues, but for some reason in this GOAT tournament, there was no dollar sign. They were points.
Oh.
And he kept going into a spiel that he had done a lot of times. And every time he said dollars instead of points, they would have to redo it.
Yeah.
Or, if a two-game total point thing that he was used to working in a certain way didn't in that tournament. That was the kind of thing that I remember him getting annoyed about.
Yeah, and somebody said to me afterwards, they were like, Alex never makes mistakes for years. He would have one mistake a month or something, and he hates it. He hates making mistakes so much. And yeah, he had to do a few corrections on that show, and he was just like, it was funny to see this guy that was always completely unfazable.
Just a sign of how unfamiliar it was to him.
Yeah.
To have to try something a third time. Yeah.
Well, obviously all of show business originates in front of an audience, live audience.
Why don't we have an audience here?
Well, I mean, it depends. We have an audience of all of these little figurines and like old ship's bells.
framed posters?
Yeah, framed posters.
They don't laugh, though.
Well.
They don't react.
They laugh in my head. Hello, little Eiffel Towers. Are you having fun? No, we don't have an audience here because, boy, when we first started recording this show, I guess it was at my house, the old farm, mm-hmm. and we did have an audience there of like the pit bulls across the street, the my Vietnamese neighbors that played really loud karaoke that I had to occasionally say, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Really?
It's not karaoke time.
Come on. Come on, friends.
It's always, who knows what time it is in Hanoi, I guess.
Well, we have done our show in front of a live audience more than once.
That's right.
How many times have we done that? Four, five, six live shows?
Four, maybe? Or was it just three? Was it San Francisco, the boat, cruise, and the Thing Festival?
Oh, the Thing Festival, right.
Is there a Seattle one I'm not remembering, like a fourth one?
I get, you know, we've done the town hall show where it's you doing... We've done town hall shows together,
but not Jeopardy,
in a couple,
right?
of different
or sorry,
con-
not,
contexts.
Not Omnibus?
Not Omnibus. Do you like to do Omnibus in front of a live audience? Did it feed you?
I think so.
Yeah.
Like we're so, I'm so unaccustomed to anybody laughing at anything we say.
Yeah.
You know? Because first of all, because it's not that funny. but second of all, you're like, oh yeah, like, you know, podcasts work for both the listener and the talent as a conversation.
Right.
So you're not thinking about playing to anyone.
Right.
Like we're just talking to each other. And I think that's what the listener likes. But there is a new element when you remember, oh, right, someone might be enjoying this at some point in time.
The shows we did for the Thing Festival, which are available in our catalog because we slotted them in just as normal episodes in the Omnibus.
Did we just do one or two?
We did two. And I thought we did. I thought those were really fun. Didn't we do two? Yeah, we did.
I remember you doing your World War II holdout show.
Right, that's right.
Was there a second one? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Omnibus historians will tell us.
But the shows we did in San Francisco were a little brutal because we were doing them at a comedy festival and we had the room, I guess, for an hour and you recorded the first show. And when we ended it, we said,
oh, yeah.
And now we're going to do a second show as the room emptied.
Everybody heading out to see Michael Ian Black somewhere.
Exactly. They were on their way to see see BoJack Horseman like cast live on stage. And I remember standing there like, no, don't leave. We're going to do a second half. And it was gone. And so I sat and did my show to a mostly empty room, and it was the Yngwie Malmsteen show.
That's right.
Which was the first Omnibus episode I did that really inspired like tons of rage from all of the
people with guitar opinions.
Yeah, all the progressive metal guys who were like, you don't know the first thing about progressive metal.
Yngwie Malmsteen has more talent in his...
Yeah,
I guess Littlefinger, but guitarists do have talent with Littlefinger.
He has actually way more talent in his little finger than I do in my whole hand.
It just occurs to me you need a different metaphor for guitarists. You can't say Littlefinger.
Yngwie Malmsteen has more talent
in his elbow,
in his long, stringy
eyebrow
hair. So yeah, that left a bad memory for me.
That's your equivalent of me having to do Jeopardy to an empty room.
Yeah,
and all the other guest hosts.
But I find it a lot. I find it to be very true when I do shows with people like the recent shows I did with Dan Carlin. Dan does not have a ton of stage time. Why would he? He didn't come up in a band or doing comedy or, you know, like
he's a writer. Does he have an academic background? Does he have classroom management?
No, he was a broadcaster. He was in radio.
I see.
And that's the thing about
radio. No audience.
Right? You've got a massive audience that you can't hear.
Unless it's 1930 and like somebody's doing like shaking one of those pieces of paper to make the thunder sound.
Yeah.
Radio should be that again, in my opinion. Horse hooves.
For a long time I was part of the Livewire show down in Portland, and they actually had a Foley artist that did
that show. I did a similar one in Bellingham once. Did Livewire ever have a little scripted radio play thing going on?
They did almost every episode, little scripted bits. Ken, I know that you know how concerned about my health I am, and as I get older, I find that I'm more and more confused and befuddled by all of the information I'm taking, these medicines. I definitely come from a family that has a history of heart issues, and my doctor only wants to talk to me for 15 minutes and then shoo me out of the space. And I've had multiple tests. I just don't quite understand how to keep it all in my head and get a comprehensive picture. That's why I recently signed up for Function Health, which is a health platform that helps me, it gives me both data and helps me coordinate my understanding of data that most people don't get from their healthcare professionals. It gives me insights into what all this information means. Inside of Function, I can test over 100 biomarkers, hormones, toxins, heart health, which is my main consideration, inflammation, which I know I have from head to toe, and certainly stress. And for additional fees, I can get MRI and chest CAT scans. And it's all tracked in one location, secure over time. It's a 360-degree view to see what's happening in my body. And I know lots of health leaders are coming out talking about Function Health. But for me, it's like finally I have a place where I can put all this information, put in all my medications, input all of the stuff, all the various tests and so forth that I already have, and then have a single place where it is sort of interpreted and I get a better picture of my overall health. So I'm going to recommend to our listeners that they also sign up for Function Health. And what's marvelous about this offer, although it's confined to our first 1,000 listeners, it's $100 off membership in Function Health. So here's what we do, or here's what I recommend you do. Here's what I just did a couple of days ago. To get this sort of 360-degree view of what's happening in your body and to get $100 credit toward your membership, go to www.functionhealth.com/omnibus, omnibus, and use the gift code OMNIBUS100 at sign up, and you'll get $100 credit toward your membership. And it's a year-long membership, and I'm really excited to see how Function Health gives me a better picture of what's going on inside my body, especially with my high blood pressure, my diabetes, and my high cholesterol, all the great shows. So once again, that's functionhealth.com/omnibus and use the gift code OMNIBUS100 at sign up to own your health. But I love performing for a crowd just because I've been up there since I was, a teenager.
It's probably the other way around. You've been doing it since you were a teenager because you like performing for a crowd.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Like, people love that. It's a great feeling. When someone's approving of something I'm doing, it's the main thing humans want.
When people used to ask me if I had an imaginary friend as a kid, which is funny because I remember being asked that a lot in the olden times, and nobody seems to ask people anymore. Yeah. Did you have an imaginary friend?
Are imaginary friends gone?
I don't know. My daughter had imaginary friends. Did your kids have imaginary friends?
Well, yes, but not long-lived ones.
Yeah, my daughter had two.
I'm not saying they died tragically, but it would be like a fascination of a week.
Your kids would kill their imaginary friends.
And murder them. And
impale them.
And have a new one would just appear out of the closet at night.
When my daughter was very young, she started talking to Lala and Ungakinga. And Lala and Ungakinga were features in our home for a long time.
I think parents keep them alive because they like them.
Yeah, but
hey, what's Lala doing?
My mom was convinced that Lala and Ungakinga are not, those are not names that a child might say Lala, but Ungakinga, my mom was convinced it was an African prince.
Wait, your mom had a supernatural theory.
Yeah, and believed that Marlo was communicating with, with ancient ghosts and was very convinced that Lala and Ungakinga were time-traveling African...
Is it problematic or good allyship that she's talking to African ghosts?
Well, they had a wonderful relationship. I have no idea what they were transacting when I wasn't around.
What kind of...
I mean,
you never found a little John Roderick-looking mannequin with pins in it?
No, we'll see. Now, that's problematic.
No, that's actual voodoo. That's real syncretic religious practice.
No, I think... And she doesn't remember Lala and Ungakinga now, but my imaginary friends from the time I was pretty young, it was always an audience.
I did that too. I'd look in the mirror and pretend I was like hosting the Tonight Show.
I'd be sitting in my room and just like, now over here, you know, welcome our guest.
Thanks for joining us.
G.I. Joe.
That's crazy. That's crazy that you and I both did that. But yeah. I don't know of any like, this is not a trope in the culture that kids do this, right?
I don't think so. I think if you were watching a movie that was like the origin story of Ken Jennings, if it was some Lifetime movie,
there would be that for sure.
There'd be this scene of you kind of lit, you're facing away from the camera into a sort of a television that's just has poltergeist static on it. And you're like, ladies and gentlemen, a little Ken with high water khaki pants and a plaid short sleeved t-shirt.
This actually, I guess you, it is a trope of people like singing into a hairbrush in front of a mirror, pretending they're on stage at, Ed Sullivan or the Apollo or whatever. Right. That's a thing.
Yeah.
But pretending to be a... let us know. If you're out there and you also grew up pretending to be a TV personality, we want to know. Because I bet this is common.
Oh, for sure.
Because it's just one of the adults you see doing adult things as a kid. Of course, you're going to mimic that.
Watching Johnny Carson, just the idea that you could get up there.
Or for Gen Z, you know, watching Mr. Beast or whatever.
Mr. Beast. But Mr. Beast doesn't have a live audience.
That's the main problem.
Most of the time, right? Well, this is the thing. All show business started as theater, and all the early radio shows were all shows performed in front of a live audience, and live audience reactions were kind of intrinsic to the media. And so in early television, those were also filmed in front of a live audience. The expectation of both radio and TV were that the audiences understood what going to the theater was, because everybody, rich or poor, had been to some kind of live performance, presumably. Even if you lived out in the sticks.
Yeah. Something would come through.
Yeah, would come through and you'd go to a show.
And it wasn't class bound. Like, you know, everybody would go see live entertainment. It might be the music hall, but there was something for every ticket price point.
Yeah, and I think it would have been, if you can imagine that it would have been conceptually difficult to put yourself in an audience position looking into somebody's family life where you were pretending that it wasn't a play, where you were like, I'm peering in a window at them.
The first time you see a TV. Yeah, you would imagine it as a proscenium.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So
it's like a play, but it's in this little glass box.
In a little glass box. So the... all of what we think of as mid-century, like show business, it all was structured around the idea of a live performance. But also, as you were saying about kinetoscopes,
Connecticut.
There was no technology of really recording broadcasts. Most broadcasts were live performances that was very new to be able to tape something, you know, except on 35 millimeter film.
There was no tape. There was no magnetic tape to store it on.
No tape.
So all you could do was point a film camera at a screen.
Yeah. And hope to God, like it made it through the airwaves.
The screen didn't roll or whatever.
And like most omnibus entries, we're going to start our story in World War II.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's like comfort food for me.
And
warm pea soup washing over me.
And here they are. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. The Nazis are back.
Are you doing your Ed Sullivan? Ladies and gentlemen, the Nazis. We should count how many shows have Nazis in them.
I bet you there is a futureling who's done it, who has a spreadsheet.
Considering how little you and I like to talk about Nazis in real life and wish we didn't have to.
Yeah. We are both very on the record as against Nazis. More and more all the time.
Well, yeah, especially now that it's been legitimized to be like kind of for the Nazis. Hitler was misunderstood is now kind of a mainstream influencer position that you and I have never shared.
5 years ago, if I had said to you, could you be more against Nazis? You would have said,
nope.
I don't think I
could. I'm already a 10.
I am 100 on the against Nazis. And yet here we are.
Now we know.
5 years later, even more against Nazis than we were before. Well, Speaking of against Nazis,
our least favorite thing, which we're going to talk about now.
In the mid-1940s, during the war, of course, radio played a major propaganda piece in the way that the kind of information was disseminated. There were actively kind of broadcasts into enemy territory, right, of
Tokyo Rose
kind of thing. And Lord Haw Haw.
Oh yeah, Lord Haw Haw.
And but also like radio as a internal mechanism of generating enthusiasm and keeping up the spirit of your local peeps with all kind with news, but also like orchestral music and just content.
Yeah, that happened on both sides of the war.
But during the war, British listeners or listeners across the channel were amazed, starting in about 42 or 43, that the Germans could keep their rate, they keep broadcasting throughout the night, that their radio stations were broadcasting, some of them now, 24 hours a day. And in examining, analyzing what was being broadcast, they realized that the Germans had a new technology, that kind of an unfathomable ability.
Is it so hard to broadcast all night?
Well, like a full show with a band and
I see. It wasn't just that they had.
It wasn't a guy that was like, No, it wasn't.
There were shows.
It was full radio.
They didn't just play Deutschland über alles and be like, and that concludes our viewing day.
No, it was astonishing. And it was one of these kind of, you know, enigma machine sort of like bafflements, mm-hmm, where intelligence and the signal corps just couldn't put together how they were able. And in listening to it, they realized that this new technology enabled them to have what was clearly something pre-recorded, up to 15 or 20 minutes long in these segments that were obviously like reduplicated, or, you know, they played in sequence enough that they were that Allied intelligence could identify it as a new media.
Mm-hmm.
But the prospect of being able to record 20 minutes of straight content and have it replayable was something they couldn't fathom.
They didn't figure out it was pre-recorded because no one had pre-recorded radio ever.
Right.
Hmm.
And it was a guy by the name of Jack Mullen, who was part of the Army Signal Corps, who was kind of key to the understanding of this being this is something that we need to figure out. And he was one of the guys in the Army that was in occupied Germany, you know, right on the heels of the invasion. Before the war was over, he was already there in Western Germany and came into possession of a tape machine called the Magnetophon, which had been developed by a German company called AEG, using tape made by a little company called IG Farben, whose name will live in infamy. And well, as you know,
not just because of the magnetic tape they made for the Nazis.
No, but for many of the other things they made for the Nazis, one thing in particular. But if you look at all those German companies at the time, Basif and Bayer, I mean, they're all just one giant,
sure,
company. They're all, and I think they had all agglomerated and then were broken apart by the Allies after the war. But Mullen got a hold of a couple of these tape machines and recognized the incredible technological advance of this effectively new technology of magnetic tape that had been perfected to the degree. And these machines were only the size of a briefcase, or, you know, it wasn't a wall of computers. Right. It was
not that different than a reel to reel you and I might imagine.
Yeah. And he was able to take two of these machines home with him.
And let me see. So it wouldn't have been a surprise to them that you could play recorded music, because the phonograph was decades old.
Right.
But people could tell that was not the technology being used here. Something with better fidelity or clarity was being used, and no one knew what.
Yeah, the problem with the phonograph is that you can hear the...
Yeah.
It's a very staticky...
You would never mistake it for a live...
Yeah, you're putting a microphone on a speaker, mm-hmm. but also a record at the time. I mean, this is before 33 and a third, right?
Yeah.
And then there were records that had spoken word. There were records that had laughter. But
it didn't sound like this.
It didn't sound like this. And it was not a contiguous program.
I guess 33 and a third existed as a technology, but was not actually commercial until after the war.
Right. So Mullen brings...
I'm just forestalling the angry letters you're going to get.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's like one guy who knows...
He was already halfway into his email, and then he's like, oh, backspace.
I feel like of our five or six figure listener base, there's only one person in the Venn diagram of knows that bit of information and also doesn't think that I know it. This is, you know, it's like, here's the group that knows I know it. Here's the group that knows it and thinks I don't. Small group. So Mullen brings the machines back and is monkeying with them and become, you know, in the post-war era, becomes a sound engineer and takes this technology around Hollywood, saying, you've got to see what this can do. Like, think of the use cases for this, and gives these demonstrations. One of them, he actually had a live orchestra play behind a curtain to an audience of film executives. And then he plays a tape of a live orchestra and the room can't tell the difference.
Mm.
And then he draws the curtain and he's like, ta-da! Am I right?
This is something that even sound film... It was better than even sound film at the time then.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And... But sort of like, meh, no takers. Nobody can quite figure out what to do. But there is a guy by the name of Murdo McKenzie who works... He's the technical director for the Bing Crosby show.
Hmm.
And at this point in time, Bing Crosby was arguably the biggest star.
Right.
On radio,
movies,
or anywhere.
Radio, top-selling recording artist.
Right,
he's Sinatra before Sinatra.
And so McKenzie is like, I want you to play this for Bing. I want you to demonstrate this to Bing, because Bing hates live radio, because it's just like you and Jeopardy. It's a scheduling. He doesn't want
to. He has to drive down to the studio every night at 8:30 to do a show for an hour.
And there's the problem of, you know, a second show for the West Coast. Like, Bing wants his life back, kind of.
He's like, I'm too famous to do this.
And so Mullen shows Bing the technology, and Bing gets it. He's like, I can do my show, and then I can go home, and you can do whatever you want with it, right? And not only that, but he sees pretty early, like, and we can edit the show.
Oh, yeah.
And tighten it up and make it like what would at the time have been like a crazily high level of production, where it's just like boom, 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 like the jokes and everything are killing it.
Radio always looks, when you see modern recreations of those live radio things, they always look just like a well-oiled machine, but I'm sure it felt so shaggy.
Yeah.
You know? Because you're watching something from a nightclub or a room that's being broadcast on the radio. There's no way it didn't sound like some hectic Anderson Cooper New Year's Eve all the time, right?
Yeah, and that was what people expected. But there was also the problem of like the Hays Code or off-color jokes. Sure, and sure. There would have been a lot of stuff to wrangle.
There's a Christian case for magnetic tape.
And so,
God smiles on magnetic tape.
And still, even now.
he's famous for it.
But so Bing goes to Ampex with $50,000 of his own money and with Jack Mullen. And they say, we want you to start manufacturing these machines. Ampex is a company that made tape and tape machines I used their equipment in all making all of my records, use their tape.
It's still to this day, it's like a...
Well, no, because all of this technology just in recent memory...
Got all digitally...
It all went away because of digital stuff. And Ampex actually now has pivoted to like some sort of digital, like, I don't know what, storage, maybe, probably storage.
Here's my pitch for them. Like, go. Tampax makes tampons. Yeah. Ampex should make ampons.
Ampons!
I don't know what ampons are.
Why weren't you there 80 years ago?
I could have literally could have helped.
What I never realized, Ampex is one of those words that sounds like Victrola or Kodak.
Yeah.
Like, it just sounds cool and like...
It's got the cool ending.
But actually, Ampex Company was founded by Alexander Poniatoff.
Oh, it's his initials?
And it stands for Alexander M. Poniatoff Excellence.
And they happen to make amps? Come on. a guy whose initials are AMP is like, I'm going into the AMP business.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And I'm naming the company after me.
Literally, his initials are AMP.
That's true of, there's some other, I think... Pam spray is like product of Arthur Mikkelsen or whoever the guy is who made it. Like
product of Arthur Mikkelsen.
There's a couple things like that where it sounds like Kodak, but really it's just some guy.
Well, so Ampex goes on to make these machines, and Bing loves them. One of the first ones he gets, he gives to Les Paul, who basically immediately invents multi-track recording with it.
Shortly, several hours later.
And then Ampex goes on with this technology to basically invent stereo recording and then three-track recording. And then Mullen and Ampex are like, how hard would it be to do this except with film? How hard would it be to put film onto magnetic tape? And they go through a long process of realizing at first they're like, there's so much more bandwidth. We're going to have to run the tape at, you know, 300 feet per second and they can't do it. So eventually they develop a head that actually records across the tape.
So it's a wider band.
Super fast across the tape. Mm. But the problem with that was, this was why it didn't used to be possible to freeze frame.
Because the head would keep going.
The head is going across it like this, and no single place on the tape is the full image.
Oh.
So anytime you froze it, it would just be some sort of partial,
Didn't that problem exist into the VCR era?
It did.
Like, you'd have to have a VCR that would have some secondary system that would digitally hold a frame. The ones before that would go...
This continued to be a problem into the 80s, because this was the technology of this head that... That moves super fast across the
tape. Today we associate that effect with ghosts. You know, it's old timey videotape that where something spooky is happening. Like, it's funny that all these effects that are caused by these magnetic technologies now read as supernatural.
Isn't that? It's what's funny is that this technology, which these few people were working on, Bing Crosby, Jack Mullen, and Alexander M. Poniatoff. Along with probably a crew of like four engineers, we're like, well, now that we've stolen this tape recording thing from the Nazis,
they basically create mass media.
Why don't we just keep working on it until we make basically everything, all of show business?
I like it because it implies the Nazis did not perfect the technology.
Well, that's the thing. They worked on a lot of things,
but they just didn't have star power.
Yeah, it took American ingenuity to steal that stuff and then hand it to basically American Jews.
Exactly.
Who then were that, like, the ultimate revenge. Like us now.
The ultimate revenge. Yeah. The Nazis just didn't have the glamour, you know?
Well, like they kicked out all the smart people.
They kicked out all the smart people and all the entertaining people, and they were too serious.
Too serious.
To realize what Bing Crosby would do with their tech.
And the first instance, really, of what we would call a laugh track actually came during the recording of a Crosby... radio special, mm-hmm. A comedian named Bob Burns, who was like a hayseed comedian, herk-a-derk-a-derk.
He pretended to be a rural guy.
Yeah. Came on and told a bunch of jokes that we would now think were just like children's nursery rhymes, but at the time they were off color enough that they couldn't be broadcast, but they killed in the room. Mm. And so the they had to cut those jokes. But one of the scriptwriters, a guy named Bill Morrow, was like, you know, we've got those laughs. Can I use those laughs on these other jokes that weren't as good? And took basically Bob Burns's laughs and
from his
pasted them on his
dirty hayloft jokes.
Yeah, exactly. His farmer's daughter jokes, and he flew them in over some other jokes, and it worked.
Does that mean those laughs got used like for years? Like you could listen to Jack Benny and you're hearing laughs from this guy?
Well, so this kind of inspired or you know, it's hard to the intellectual property of an idea like this, like, oh, we took these laughs or any kind of editing of a radio program where it's like, well, that didn't really kill in the room, but if we took out the long pause and just slammed it up against another joke, you know, what we think of as all of editing.
Yeah, how it should work. Did that strike anybody as unethical?
I don't think so. I mean, this was all just probably a great gift to anybody in doing comedy. There's always going to be some stick in the mud that's like, well, I don't mean to call him a stick in the mud, but when we were mastering the first Long Winter's record, we mastered the record, as I have done with all my records, with a guy named Ed Brooks, who works here in Seattle at RFI Mastering. And Ed is a marvelous guy and a great artist. But one of his other jobs, or one of his mastering jobs, is that he masters all the Pearl Jam stuff, and all of the Pearl Jam really services their fan community with a lot of live recordings. Right. They do multi-track recordings of all their shows. And Ed does all of that work. And we were mastering the first Long Winter's record, and I'm kind of, you know, still pretty new. I'm sitting in the room with him and I'm like, you know, it'd be great as if at the end of this song, like made it sound like it was in a big stadium, like big crowd noise. And Ed was like, that's a great idea, you know, like find some crowd noise. And I said, well, we're sitting here in a room with like 70,000 hours of Pearl Jam recordings. Well, can't we just fly in some of that? And he got really serious and he was like, that's Pearl Jam's applause. Like that.
Stolen valor.
You're not getting Pearl Jam applause.
But wouldn't the applause on this little indie record, wouldn't everyone know that this arena rock sound was a,
that's what I was
a
saying.
Tape library thing?
That's what I was saying. Like clearly, you know, we don't have 50,000 screaming fans.
Everyone would know it was dropped in from Peter Frampton or whatever.
Right. I mean, I could go and get the crowd noise from a Nuremberg rally, but that would be a bummer too. Like, can I just have...
Especially if you can hear the chants.
Can't you just pull up this tape that's right here and put... And
he Live was in like, Fresno, 2011?
No, you cannot use my Pearl Jam crowd sound. So I although there are... some ethics probably in indie rock or rock and roll about it. I don't think anybody
at the time was like, this is just because it was new. Nobody was like, this is wrong. They were like, this is easier. Let's do it.
So at this time, there's still a lot of TV shows being filmed at most, well, maybe all right prior to this, still being filmed in front of a live audience. And a CBS sound engineer by the name of Charlie Douglas started, one of the problems they had was not just that some jokes didn't land, but as we were talking about before, the audience reaction sometimes was too much. And
slows it down.
Yeah, it would step over people. You could see people just sort of waiting for the laughter to die down. Or there's one guy with a bad laugh in the audience, and it's just like, oh, that's grating. And Charlie Douglas started to what he called sweeten the crowd response in real time. Like developed this sort of little small library of applause and laughter that he could mix in with real crowd response.
Was it also in the room?
Yeah.
The performers and the crowd could hear this, but they weren't aware.
I think he was mixing it in post-production.
Oh, okay. So they can't hear.
No, but he then had enough control through a mixer of the crowd sound in the room that he could lower the faders on too much laughter. Lower the faders on obnoxious laughter, add in a little bit of merry laughter or, you know, pre-laugh laughter.
He probably becomes like a DJ of like, you know what we need here is 11B.
Well, he does. And he, as soon as videotaped television shows came in and live audiences were gone, television executives could not conceive of a show that didn't have that. The assumption was that people still expected these programs to be received as theater.
As if you're watching with a live audience that the actors can hear.
Now we have the videotape developed by the Bing Crosby organization under the Ampex name. And now we're making shows like Bewitched and The Munsters, right, and The Beverly Hillbillies, where it's not necessarily in front of a live audience, or partly or not at all.
A lot of it, there's some high concept that wouldn't actually work with a live audience. You couldn't do I Dream of Jeannie or even Gilligan's Island with a live audience. It's the elaborate sets and there were a few shows. I think Dick Van Dyke still used a live studio audience during this period, but he was well aware that, you know, that was Carl Reiner being like, we're still going to do this the old theatery way. Like, even though this is not how comedy, even though all comedy now is Get Smart, we're going to be the one show still doing this.
Right.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Yeah, and we'll see throughout our lives, there are plenty of sitcoms that got filmed in front of a live studio audience, like Cheers and whatnot, but also lots of shows like Gilligan's Island or MASH, right, which you couldn't possibly do
For technical reasons.
But the idea that laughter needed to be a part of any kind of situation comedy was so deeply ingrained in it that it would have been inconceivable to a network executive or to anybody producing a show starting in the kind of golden age of sitcoms, that first golden age of the late 50s, early 60s. And Charlie Douglas very quickly left CBS and became a laugh producer.
Freelance laugh guy?
A freelance laugh guy. He compiled this collection of reels of laughs that he'd kind of pruned and picked and carefully curated. And he built a box that he called the Laugh Box. And it's LAFF, Laugh Box.
That makes it a little less dystopian, but not that much.
The Charlie Douglas Laugh Box. And it's about the same size as, it's bigger than a space heater. It's like bigger than a...
Oh, it's bigger than you'd think. It's bigger than an Apple II.
It's probably as big as those end tables stacked up there. It's probably...
That really helps our audience.
Yeah, 2 or 3 feet tall by...
Should I take a picture of the end tables?
Yeah, take a picture of the end. That's a set of nesting tables.
We need a banana for scale.
Nesting tables that my grand aunt brought back from Hong Kong. So it looks like a little teletype machine. It had keys. It had reels of tape that were running at all times. And he had...
It's like a Mellotron kind of?
It's very much like a Mellotron. He had 32 tapes that were always spinning. And on those 32 tapes, he had sort of 320 different combinations of laughs and applause. It had foot pedals that he could bring in applause. And it was touch sensitive. So the longer you held something, the harder you pushed on it, the laughs grew in intensity.
And not just in volume. It's actually bringing in different
layers. Tapes.
That's great.
So more and more. And there's like raucous laughing. There's like chuckling. There's a bunch of guys, harumph, harumph, harumph. And there's like people screaming. He's got Ed Sullivan laughs and Beatles cheers and all these things that he's collected in his career. And he becomes effectively the monopolist of creating laughs. And when he would work on a show, producers would say that he laughed it.
Like, oh, that's a verb.
Hey, let's get this, you know, let's get Charlie Douglas in here to laugh this show.
It's not the gig economy, it's the giggle economy.
It's the giggle economy. And he kept his machine top secret. He wouldn't let producers in the room. He worked, you know, it had a lid that he could close and lock so nobody could see how it worked. And he developed this kind of, like, basically laugh economy. Nobody else could do, nobody else could laugh a show because it was very distinctive. Charlie Douglas watched the show and laughed it live.
It would get to the point where audiences would associate the sound of TV comedy with his particular laughing style.
Right.
And they wouldn't, even if somebody else were to try it, they would be like, well, that sounds weird. That,
it is, sounds,
that
weird.
Sounds fake.
Right. How would you even begin to do it if you hadn't built this extremely organic device?
Yeah.
And then he would, you know, and he had a sense of, a real sense of comedy and of television. He could anticipate where the jokes were going to be. He understood which ones were big laughs, which ones were little laughs.
He's a performer.
And he was a performer. And he could laugh a show that had no studio audience. He could laugh one that had a studio audience.
Like replacing or just kind of sweetening?
Sweetening. You know, it became an essential part of what we think of as 60s television. As we moved into the 70s, at this point, Douglas had a little team of young men that he was training to laugh shows. They were called the Laugh Boys. And kind of his main apprentice was a man named Carol Pratt. And Carol Pratt and his brother John became Douglas's, like, right-hand assistants. And they got so good at the machine that they could laugh shows on their own. Mm-hmm. And they had enough of it. There was enough distinction between the way that Carol laughed a show compared to the way Charlie or John laughed a show that producers would request specific guys to laugh their show.
In the same way that you would pick a studio musician.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I really, you know what? This show really wants a Carol take on it. But into the 70s now, there became, you know, there was a much more of a sense of authenticity coming into TV. It's very different to put a laugh track on All in the Family.
Yeah, the Get Smart shows, they're very synthetic. You get the sense that it's being put on as a goof, almost campy Batman style. Whereas I heard Norman Lear talk a couple of times before he died, and he was always very proud of the fact that he would never use a laugh track. That's, I think maybe All in the Family was the first show where Rob Reiner would say, filmed live before a studio audience. I think that was an Archie Bunker innovation.
Yeah, and throughout the 70s, there was now this next generation of producers and showrunners who were like, I don't want a laugh track. It's old vaudeville sound.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to be realer. And the television executives really pushed back. They did not think that this was going to fly. And weirdly, if you interview audiences, a lot of people will say, no, I don't want a laugh track. You know, it's condescending. Yeah. And laugh tracks are, but they prefer laugh tracks.
Have we talked before about Larry Gelbart and MASH?
Yeah. And that's sort of one of the key turning points for laugh tracks is MASH. Carol and John started to, in the mid 70s, recognize that, first of all, Charlie's tapes were starting to hiss.
Oh, yeah.
He'd used them so many times, and they were trying to encourage him, like, hey, we've got to get some new technology, new tapes. Like, we can improve on this system. And Charlie was, like any aging artist, very resistant to change. And he was like, no, this has been working and it still works great. I think this was probably the first time that people started to say, like, all of the laughs you're hearing are from dead people. Like, all of the people that are laughing at this joke have been dead for 15 years. But the Pratts eventually break off from Douglas and start their own company called Sound One. And one of the things about the Pratts was they had a much gentler style.
They wanted to sound more,
yeah, they could,
lifelike.
They could produce laughs that were like, ha, 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 ha. Like, murmurs and
probably more like how a live room would sound in the 70s compared to 1958, right?
Yeah. And that's a very different style. I mean, these new sitcoms aren't all slapstick. Yeah. Some of the jokes are cultural criticism. There's a lot of, you know, the Jeffersons are making a lot of slip on a banana peel jokes, but they're also making jokes about racial, like serious topics.
Yeah, basically every half hour is tackling something.
And so the Pratts had a much more, they had the ability to laugh a show with a much lighter touch. And the fact that the producers of MASH did not want, that was, you know, a huge hit, biggest show on television, and kind of forced to use a laugh track by American producers. When MASH aired overseas, it didn't have laughs.
Well, think about it. They're adapting like this kind of this cultural touchstone black comedy about war, and everybody's seen what Robert Altman's MASH looks like, and now we're going to have the TV version just sound like Get Smart.
Right.
I can totally see their point of view.
And the producers of MASH insisted that there be no laugh track for operating room scenes.
In the operating room.
And they pushed that through. But as the show went on, they used less and less laugh track. And
I have noticed, though, when I watch it, maybe I've told you this before, knowing this, when I watch it back, I actually kind of miss the laugh track. Because you can get it on, now you get it on DVD, you get it on home video or streaming, and you can choose to watch it with the laugh track or not. And of course, all the fans are like, finally, we can watch Larry Gelbart's dream of not having the laugh track. But it seems kind of airless and dead. The pauses are still there.
Yeah, and you get...
culturally, we expect there to be a laugh when Alan Alda says something sardonic.
And in the later episodes, when Alan Alda became more and more sanctimonious, the show was just more and more sort of like, oh, God. I mean, it was great, right? I mean, we were all... I watched every episode of MASH.
I want to say the finale has no laugh track, even as...
No laugh track. There's no laugh track in the finale. And interestingly, like very famously, a woman wrote Gene Reynolds just a letter begging him to take the laugh track off of MASH. And she was actually Carol Pratt's girlfriend, future wife.
Oh.
He married her having...
Did he know that she had...
I think she
lost him work?
I think she went behind his back and was like, please, this laugh track that my boyfriend is doing for your show is killing the show. But so after that, right, we're living in a world where you would think all of the great Parks and Rec comedies and
kind of that mockumentary house style that they all have now.
Yeah, the modern sensibility is anti-laugh track. And in fact, in 2021, there were no new shows greenlit with a laugh track.
Mm.
And it was heralded as the end of the era for laugh tracks. You know, your and my favorite show, Big Bang Theory, was the last big, big show to have a laugh track.
Oh, yeah. Young Sheldon is like maybe single camera, right?
Yeah. And so hipsters have been calling for the end to laugh tracks in television for three decades. And it was, you know, it was just very recently kind of, it seemed like the writing was on the wall that laugh tracks were a thing of the past. But interestingly, of the shows that are kind of debuting this year, 2025, five of the new shows, the new situation comedies don't have laugh tracks. Seven of them do.
Ah.
And some of it is, I think, down to the fact that a lot of the shows that are being promoted as comedies, like The Bear, is a comedy, supposedly, but...
I guess the dawn of the laugh trackless comedy was these shows that started to straddle that, like, all right? Like Malcolm in the Middle is a comedy, but it's also, you know, it's the Wonder Years. It feels like a drama too.
Yeah, right. You're not laughing at a lot of the stuff that's happening here. The problem is now all television is so freaking gritty that it's maybe a world in which the weirdness, the weird fantasy of a laugh track is going to become
Like it's an antidote,
or maybe it's part of the palette of the next generation of television people who feel like, you know, this is supposed to be surreal. Comedy on television is not anymore trying to be theater, but nor is it trying to be just a camera following people around where they look awkwardly back into the camera. Like maybe the documentary is also a passé way of thinking, right, of...
You would never do both. You would never do the mockumentary thing and the laugh track thing. It seems to violate some internal rule.
Right.
I'm trying to imagine a younger audience that doesn't go to the movies as much is not used to sitting in a room watching funny comedy happen while people laugh around them, because they're watching them just at home or on a screen or whatever. But there's still tons of entertainment where you're used to crowd noise laughter. You watch just, you know, endless stand-up specials, right?
Endless stand-up specials, but also reruns of Friends.
Oh, for sure.
Are the most popular on the internet still.
So you still have that cultural connection.
Yeah. If you took the laugh track out of those, it'd be like traumatizing Gen Z.
Yeah, Gen Z watches so much Seinfeld, in my experience, that it's not, the laugh track is not a foreign language to them.
They expect to
watch acted out little playlet comedies while an unseen crowd laughs with you.
That's right. So I don't think the laugh track is dead.
The people in it are dead.
The people, all of those laughs are from dead people now. I wonder if
they know that, like, you know, in the afterlife, if they're ghosts are woken every time their laugh is used.
If Lala and Unga Kinga are like, we were laughing, Marlo, come.
We love Jack Benny.
What's crazy is that, I forget when it was, probably now a decade ago, a guy showed up at Antiques Roadshow who had bought a storage space in one of those like storage space auctions where some guy walks a group of bottom feeders through a storage space and is like, what am I bid for this one? And you look in, it's a bunch of boxes and a washing machine and some rakes. And somebody, one of the guys, you know, paid $500 for one of these storage spaces. And in the storage space was the laugh box.
Was there only one?
There was only one. It's Charlie Douglas's laugh box, which he wheels into Antiques Roadshow. And one of the, you know, the classic Antiques Roadshow guys with the white ponytail is like, are you freaking kidding me?
Do you know what this is?
And he fires it up and it works. And they sit on the show and, you know, and the guy that brought it in is like, yeah, I thought this was, I mean, I was going to throw it away, but then I saw these tapes and it's like Beatles cheers and Ed Sullivan laughs, and yeah, plugged in, and they sit and play it on the show, like just pushing buttons and big laughs and applause and guffaws and all this stuff. And then the guy said, I estimate that this would sell for $10,000.
Bet it's more.
And so I went online, like, where is this thing now and where did it sell? And I couldn't find, I didn't have all day to try and track it down, but I didn't see any quick return on my search that this guy had actually sold the laugh box.
So maybe he still got it.
Maybe. I mean, he seemed like he's a guy that's buying storage spaces. So if he does, it would if I had it in this room sitting here next to the, you know, next to the space heater, the laugh box, the only one, I feel like it is maybe one of the great talismans of our time.
I like to imagine that guy, maybe the kind of guy who bids on storage locker auctions, maybe he doesn't have like a, you know, the liveliest home life. You know, maybe he goes home to an empty apartment.
Or a wife that's like doesn't appreciate him.
A wife who's like, yeah, shut up about your auctions.
And he keeps it plugged in next to his lazy boy.
And he tells a joke to the cat and the cat just looks at him and then he presses the thing. Hey, buddy. So he's still tired from sleeping all day, huh? Ah, the cat just watches him.
Honey, my coffee's cold.
Wait, is that a joke? I guess that could be a sitcom joke.
That's for sure a Friends joke.
That's the quality of all sitcom jokes. And that concludes Laugh Tracks, entry 704.EC0202, certificate number 37919, in the omnibus. John, we talked about the Jeopardy guest host rotation earlier.
That's right.
Kind of the oddness of that. But we were not deterred by how odd that was.
No, Jeopardy spent an entire year bringing guest hosts from across the celebrity universe.
A weird cavalcade of morning show hosts and sportscasters and news commentators.
And all like shoehorned into this cavernous empty space.
Laugh trackless studio.
And performing for nobody, and then with laughs put in afterwards, right? Applause put in afterwards?
Yeah, all sweetened afterwards.
Super weird. Do you think that contributed to how few of those guest hosts really thrived in that environment?
I kind of wonder. I think it would have gone differently. On the other hand, Jeopardy's technically a very hard show to do, and a lot of those, as a result, a lot of those guest hosts were there hosting until 9 o'clock at night, and a studio audience would have been tuckered out.
Right. Well, as a lot of our listeners probably have heard already,
some will know this, and some will not.
This will be your introduction to the idea. We have reached a moment in the Omnibus program where your many responsibilities in Hollywood, hanging out with Matt Damon and riding around in jet boats.
Mostly hanging out with Matt Damon. That's kind of my main job task at the moment.
Yeah, but that's all making it more and more and more difficult for you to continue to record the Omnibus project on a weekly basis, right?
We've had the hardest time. I've known this for years.
Yeah.
That it was just not going to be sustainable, but I was like, well, maybe we can just build ahead of steam this summer and pre-record a lot of episodes. And somehow for two or three years, we hung in there.
Yeah.
You know, we were able to just always get a show recorded when we needed it, even if I was like the one day I was in town that month.
But lately you've taken over the whole hosting role of Jeopardy, and you're now in a kind of 12 months a year on call basis.
Yeah, we hardly ever have a hiatus.
So we've been talking about this for months, that you are going to need to transition away from doing it as a weekly project. And that has sort of, made us, we've spent quite a few weeks trying to imagine who could fill your shoes, who could step in with your unique combination of moral smugness and like
thinly concealed scorn,
but also, you know, your wit and your dad humor.
I like doing this show, and I'm interested in, you know, pretty much every element of, like, no matter what topic we handle, I'm a guy who's like, well, yeah, like, let's go deep on whatever weird thing this is.
Yeah, you're not.
I've never heard of this, but I don't mind.
It's not possible to replace you, really. I mean, because I know a lot of comedians, but comedians are deeply broken people. They're broken in a way that you are not broken, right? That's one of the marvelous things about hosting this show with you.
Couldn't you just do a lot of therapy to a comedian?
Ah, boy, I don't have the time or the money to try and rehabilitate a comedian.
What's easier, to rehabilitate a comedian or to like teach comedy to a monk?
To make someone that's smart and interesting also funny? That's also very difficult to do. So
that was kind of the Jeopardy challenge, by the way. Do you find a broadcaster and teach them Jeopardy? Or do you take somebody who actually understands the game and try to make them a broadcaster? It turned out they were both very difficult.
Well, and I think when you first took over the show, whatever small proportion of the audience it was that was resistant to you,
I don't think it was small.
Was like,
but it was clear that I was not in my element.
Yeah,
I think to people who were like, "Oh, this guy, okay."
You didn't have the stage time that we were talking about before,
right?
But now you do, and look at you up there, just jeopardying like nobody's business. And honestly, Alex is not Pat Sajak, or wasn't Pat Sajak. He clearly had a childhood friend that was an audience.
He's a Sajak of all trades. He can do any show.
Pat Sajak, Alex Trebek was clearly, his childhood friend was probably a raccoon.
Maybe the hatchet he used for firewood?
Yeah, a little different. But so in trying to replace you and realizing that you're irreplaceable, we have sort of started to discuss having what would, I think, be maybe a recapitulation of the Jeopardy search.
Because we love how that went.
It went great, and it was hilarious.
No notes.
No notes at all. And the thing about it is we're both very committed to the concept of the omnibus. There is so much left to put into the record.
And for my part, this is what makes this not just bittersweet, but very sad for me. Because it's not that I don't enjoy doing the show anymore. I love it. I'm just...
Even though for half the episodes, you're just looking at you're playing a game on your iPad.
Just doing Candy Crush. Yeah. That's mostly what I like about it, is that it's a lot of time to do my New York Times games while someone else kind of talks to me. I use the podcast the way our listeners do. I just need something on in the car.
You fall asleep to it. That's right. So anyway, for our listeners who are just hearing this for the first time, Omnibus is going to stay on the air. Ken is going to transition to an emeritus status where you come in, am I correct, and host shows periodically.
Yeah, I want to still be in. Unlike with Alex, I'm still here and can be in the guest host rotation.
That's right.
Which is exciting.
We're going to have somewhat of maybe a little bit of a laugh track where Ken has some sort of...
A mellotron of me?
Yeah, a little some sound effects of you looking at your phone, sound effects of you shuffling papers around, but also probably accusing people of not being compatible with Marxism, et cetera, et cetera. But what we're going to do now is slot a different host in Ken's chair. And rather than just cherry pick my co-hosts from a short list of
Seattle indie rockers
and broken comedians, although we will have a fair supply of Seattle indie rockers and broken comedians. Also people from American cultural life that between Ken's Rolodex and mine and our many people that we know that still use Rolodexes.
Rolodices.
We're going to have some guests, but also in, I think, one of the most exciting innovations.
This is very omnibus, I think.
Yeah. We're going to open up the guest host slot to futurelings. If you are a listener of the show
I think you are.
I have to assume.
Many of you are.
Unless you're only hearing this as a 15-second snippet.
Because your spouse has it on and you haven't hit stop on the iPhone fast enough.
If you're someone who has always wanted to or has consistently submitted show ideas to us, if you're someone who has an area of expertise that maybe people in your life don't recognize or appreciate, if you see in the wild show ideas that appeal to you and you think you can make the case for it to be included in the omnibus.
It used to be one of the most common things we would hear from people is like, you gotta do.
Yeah.
And then they would say, that those guys that disappeared in the Himalayas, or you know, they'd have a pet thing that they love and want to talk about. And now they can.
Why haven't you done a show on laugh tracks, for instance? No, that's been in my list. Anyway, so what we've done is we have turned the omnibusproject.com, or rather omnibusproject.com, into a sign-up portal for people to come and say, here's my show idea, and here's how I'm going to present it. And that's omnibusproject.com/guest. Go on, you'll find a sign up,
Guest singular, G-U-E-S-T.
Guest singular. You'll find an onboarding kind of questionnaire. And once we get...
Make your pitch.
Yeah, once we get the pitches, we'll slot you in along with people that are going to be kind of coming in from across the spectra of pundits
and neurodivergent
and neurodivergent people and people who are
so many
spectra leaders,
so many spectra to be represented.
And as part of this, you know, I have now I've got a manager, I've got a webmaster. Mark Miles is going to continue to produce the show.
We've been building a lot of infrastructure.
We have.
For this moment when I'm like in Seattle less and can't oversee a lot of this.
We hate the idea that maybe some of you feel like we have not been entirely forthcoming as we've been thinking about this, because it's been on our minds for several months trying to make this.
We just didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
We've been talking about how to do this for months.
Yeah. And it's obvious like this couldn't go on forever. You're doing cocaine off a hooker's ass somewhere. A jet airplane.
We did over 700 shows if you count the addenda.
Close to 8 years. It will be 1 month shy of 8 years.
wow, why couldn't I just stick it out for one more month?
That's what I've been telling
people. What a quitter.
People are like, is Ken really leaving? And I'm like, yeah, guess what? A month before eight.
On purpose.
But you keep saying, oh, I'm not quitting. I'm coming back. I'm coming back all the time. When you least expect me.
I think when you least expect you might be more accurate than all the time. But I think I will miss it. That's my prediction.
Oh, I know you will.
Yeah.
You don't have any real friends.
No.
I'm the only one.
This is like the only conversation I ever have, and it's 7 hours long because we do three shows at a time. This is like aversion therapy to having friends.
That's right. And one other thing, and this may be, I mean, I know a lot of you are like, oh my God, the only reason I listen to this show is to hear Ken, and I mute John whenever he starts talking.
In that case, my new podcast will be called No.
But we're also going to pivot the new show to YouTube.
Ooh.
And we're going to start recording these interviews as video calls. So I know there were some of you who were already preparing your proposal, and then the idea of doing it on video made you
more excited.
Made you gasp and think, no, please, not me. And we can work around that, I think.
Can we put a Snapchat filter on you? Like all your guests will be kitty cats.
A little bit of that. I thought maybe we could get a puppeteer, and as somebody that wants to do the show but doesn't want to be on camera, we'll just have a puppeteer do them.
That's a great idea.
Like a sock.
You're imagining a vast group of Omnibus listeners with a lot of free time who A, are puppeteers,
yeah,
and B, want to be on the show but don't have any ideas for it.
Well, no, I think we want only people that have ideas for it.
Not to be I see. They're the ones who are talking.
Yeah, the puppet's doing the talking.
I thought you would have a second person holding up the puppet for the camera shy guest host.
Well, we might do that too. I'm saying I might hire a puppeteer along with my webmaster and manager.
Well, yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying if we have listeners who are puppeteers.
Oh, there we go. Kill both. So
if you have an idea but not a puppet, you can be on Omnibus. If you have a puppet but not an idea, you can also be on Omnibus.
You are hired.
If you have a puppet and an idea, you are Jim Henson and are going to take over entertainment.
So anyway, go to omnibusproject.com/guest if you want to apply for the show. We're going to continue to record episodes together.
This transition will happen later this year, yep. With some fanfare, by the way.
And I think we're free to announce that the final show that we're doing together before the start of these new shows will be a live show filmed here in Seattle or recorded here in Seattle. Yep. We haven't worked out whether it's going to be filmed or not, but recorded at least at Town Hall on November...
If all goes according to plan, the evening of November 8th will be a big live Omnibus celebration here in Seattle.
So that show should be announced either now or in the next day or two on the Town Hall website. And so we'll be doing the live final Ken Omnibus, or at least final until he shows up unannounced.
For the moment.
And there'll be a Q&A, and at one point, you know, we'll carry Ken across the audience on a giant litter that's covered with fruit and wine.
Eddie Vedder's going to play Alive in honor of the fact that Omnibus is continuing.
No. Yep. And then for the rest of you, I know that you don't want to be left alone with me in a room without Ken there to make sure that there's no inappropriateness.
No shenanigans.
But I
will be assigning a Mormon... adjudicator.
That's right.
To observe every show and report back to me on any violations of my own personal
Someone
moral code.
With a clipboard that'll just sit here and say, like,
John's drinking coffee
don't
again.
Think so.
Don't love the coffee.
So, yes, I'm not imploring you because this is how show business goes, but I do welcome you to join me and my exciting new iteration of the Omnibus Project, where we're going to continue to record history's mysteries into the Omnibus, but we're going to be welcoming a lot of smart, interesting, entertaining people, and also some people that maybe have never would never have been described by any of their friends or family as smart or interesting
or entertaining.
But
finally, they get their chance to shine.
They're going to add their piece to the Omnibus Project.
I kind of like the idea of this because you're a very good conversational partner. In fact, you do so professionally now. Like you get flown all over America to be a good conversational partner.
I like talking to people.
I think you are up to the challenge of this.
I've been for many, many years talking to people that are
that don't want to talk to you.
Well, that are uncomfortable talking.
They just happen to get the middle seat on that flight.
And I'm like, don't you know how many barges there are on America's waterways? They're like, oh my God, please.
Anyway, a bittersweet announcement, and it's fine to have big feelings about it. We certainly do here. But I'm still excited to be, you know, consulting and producing Omnibus, and John and I are going to just still hang out, but we don't have to, like, worry about talking about the Russian Revolution every time we do, which
would
be nice.
We get to.
That's right.
Rather than have to.
That's right. We'll be talking about the Russian Revolution by choice, man.
Mindy will say, hey, John is here. Hey, how are you, John? I'll be like, oh my God, do you know how many barges I saw on the way here?
You're going to be accumulating barge material now that I'm not talking to you once a week about them. We are Romain, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, and at Omnibus Project on various social media channels. You can still write to us. In fact, we need your correspondence more than ever at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. The Futurelings, I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about this at facebook.com/futureling. Wait, is that it? Whatever the Futurelings group is, there's also a subreddit and whatnot.
Discord.
There's a Discord. Send us things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. That may change at some point, because I don't know if I want to keep picking up your mail.
No, I'm going to get a new post office box. There's a lot to
do. You want one more convenient to you.
I do, and there's one right here. You know, I did quite a bit of research on this. There's the U.S. Postal Service post office boxes, and then there's the UPS post office boxes that are more expensive but have more options, as the American system dictates.
Yes, let's privatize away the post office.
And I love the Postal Service.
The band?
I also don't mind them. Yeah, the soundtrack of our lives.
Of Tron.
You wouldn't have Beach House without them. But
Beach House is just somebody playing the first Postal Service record like a laugh track box.
La 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 la. But I was very confused. I looked online and some people over here are saying your United States Postal Service post office box will not accept packages from UPS or Federal Express or
I believe that's true.
Amazon.com or whatever.
Is the reverse not true?
And the UPS boxes will accept from everybody.
Because the mail goes everywhere, and UPS is like, we're going to be hard about using PO box.
What I don't know is how many people have sent us books on the shmoo to your post office box, and it's gotten sent back because it wouldn't accept it. We'll never know.
Because they tried to UPS it?
Yeah, they tried to UPS it.
People understand when you hear a PO box, you should not be trying to FedEx something to
people. People understand.
Less than you'd think?
So I don't know. Anyway, there's a UPS store that's just like 1 mile from here, and the post office is a full 2.5 miles from here.
Well, my post office is like
75 miles.
15 miles. Yeah, I go to Enumclaw to get the mail.
Anyway, there will be a new post office box, and probably what we'll do is have Mark Miles fly in that post office box to every outro in our 800 shows.
So that nobody keeps sending stuff to mine. It's not a. I kept that. I had that PO box long before we did Omnibus.
I know.
So if Omnibus stuff continues to trickle into it, I'm still going to see you, and we're going to do Omnibus stuff sometime. So. Yeah. It's just a matter of...
You'll bring it in a big box like you do now.
I'll be like Santa.
Or it's like, you haven't been to your post office box in a month and a half, have you?
I mean, I really do need to keep an eye on that post office box because people send me stuff there.
I know they do.
In addition
dead
to...
cats.
Sending... No, they send me boring stuff. They send cool stuff to Omnibus. They just send me their book manuscript galleys they want me to blurb or something like that. The Omnibus Patreon will continue unabated.
The Omnibus Patreon is going to be a... even more important than it was before, because before, one of our co-hosts here was a millionaire who just spent his Omnibus money lighting cigars that he didn't even smoke because he's Mormon and they don't smoke.
I was lighting other people's cigars.
Yeah, you're walking around
lighting
joints of the hippies crashed out in front of your favorite bookstore.
That's what I do.
But now it's basically funding the entire operation of the show. It's the only thing that keeps me even able to eat cold SpaghettiOs out of a can.
You've got a manager and a webmaster now.
I've got to get SpaghettiOs for those guys too.
And so we're going to make sure the Patreon continues unabated with, in fact, like kind of new cool content to make sure it continues to be a good
new cool content
proposition for listeners.
And with the YouTube show. Honestly, none of us have ever done a thing like that. And in fact, Ken and I were talking earlier today, like, I don't even know if I'm going to, what kind of clothes should I wear? Should I just dress like King Neptune every week? Should I wear like a jaunty hat, kind of like a baseball hat on sideways, like I'm a little kid in a...
Remember we did that photo shot when we had the Fallout suits on?
Yeah.
What if you did the whole show in one of those
props? Just like dressed as Devo?
And you make the... Yeah. And you make the guest also. We will ship you your fake Devo suit. Please put it on now. Everyone cleans. So patreon.com/omnibusproject remains your go-to source for getting cool omnibus bonus content and supporting the show now that it's no longer a grant from the Ford Foundation.
That's right.
It's just viewers like you now, baby.
That's right.
Viewers like you. Thank you for your support of Omnibus.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.